Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Excuse me, I had a sore throat for a few weeks, about 10 days, and so the throat is not completely clear yet. Okay, so tonight we will study the sutta called Brahma Nimantanika Sutta. This is sutta number 49 of the Majjhima Nikaya, and it begins on page 424. And this is a somewhat, I have to say, frankly, it's a somewhat strange sutta, which perhaps it can be read at several levels. And now what's interesting is that, okay, this sutta takes place as a dialogue principally between the Buddha and a certain deity by the name of Bhaka the Brahma. The word Bhaka, which is given as a proper name of this deity, means in Pali and also Sanskrit, it has the meaning of a water bird, probably a crane. Which seems like a rather peculiar name to give to a deity. And I don't know the reason why this deity has that particular name. Now, in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Saggatha Samyutta, this is the connected discourses with verses, we find a short sutta. This is chapter 6, sutta number 4 in the Samyutta Nikaya. A short sutta which takes the form of a discussion or dialogue between the Buddha and the same deity, Bhaka the Brahma. The short sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya begins almost exactly in the same way as this sutta does, with the passage about Brahma imagining that his world is permanent, everlasting, eternal. Then the Buddha disappears from the earth and reappears before the Brahma deity and then tells him that he's fallen into ignorance. And so in the Samyutta Nikaya Sutta, the text is pretty much exactly the same as in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta up to the second line on page 425. But at that point, then Bhaka challenges the Buddha that if the Buddha thinks that he is wiser than himself, then the Buddha should tell him about his past deeds of merit. And then the Buddha speaks in verse and recites four verses which describe the past meritorious deeds of Bhaka, the Brahma, which account for his rebirth in the Brahma world. One of these is that he gave water to many people who were afflicted with thirst. A second is that on one occasion a group of people had been abducted by thieves, and Bhaka, well, a human being, came to them and released them from captivity. On a third occasion, a ship floating down the Ganges River was seized by a fierce spirit, a Naga spirit, and Bhaka, as a human being, freed it by a courageous act. And then the fourth incident mentioned by the Buddha is that in a past life, Bhakka had been a spiritual teacher, a religious teacher, by the name of Kesava, and the Buddha himself, as the Bodhisattva, has been his pupil named Kappa, and the pupil had been very intelligent and devout and looked after his teacher with great care and loving kindness. At that point, Bhakka the Brahma becomes, you could say, convinced by the Buddha that this being in front of him is truly the Buddha, and then Bhakka the Brahma praises the Buddha in verse. And that is the end of the sutta. Now it seems to me very improbable that the Buddha made two separate visits to Bhakka the Brahma on both occasions with the purpose of dissuading him from a view of eternalism. So my supposition or hypothesis would be that the sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya is the older and more original sutta. And then that sutta, which served as the nucleus for this Majjhima Nikaya sutta, which then came to be elaborated to give it, you might call, a more philosophical foundation, or to draw out maybe to insert some kind of philosophical implications into this discussion between Bhakka and the Buddha. Okay, to understand a little bit what is going on in this dialogue, perhaps I have to sketch some of the background of the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddhist worldview. Okay, according to Buddhism, this particular realm in which we're existing, this human world, is not the only realm of existence, but there are many higher realms of existence, and also many lower realms. And the lowest of the, let's say, the lowest division comprising the realms of existence is what we call the sense sphere realm, or the realm of desire. The realm of desire includes the hells, the animal realm, the realm of the pretas, or hungry ghosts, tormented spirits, the human realm, and then it includes six heavenly realms, realms of greater happiness, bliss. But in all of these realms, one could say that the motivating force of the living beings is sensual desire. This is why it's called the desire realm. Now, above the desire realm is another realm called the form realm, the Rupa Dhatu. The form realm has, again, it has many subdivisions, but the basic principle of the subdivisions of the form realm are according to the four meditative absorptions, the four jhanas. This gets to be rather complex. But we could say the form realm is divided first into four main layers. And these four main layers correspond to the four meditative absorptions, the four states of deep samadhi called the jhanas. And so those who become very skilled in attaining, say, the first jhana, have a disposition to be reborn in the lowest stratum of the form realm. Those who master the second jhana will have a disposition to be reborn in the second layer of the form realm. Those who master the third jhana will be disposed to rebirth in the third layer. Those who Master, the fourth jhana, will be disposed to be reborn in the fourth highest layer of the form realm. Within each of these four layers, or strata, are subdivided into three secondary layers. And which of these secondary layers one will be reborn in depends upon one's proficiency in that particular jhana. If one has a little bit of proficiency, one gets reborn in the lowest of the three stratum. If one has a middle degree of proficiency, that leads one to the middle stratum, middle band. If one has a superior degree of proficiency, that leads one to the higher band, the higher realm, sub-realm. Maybe it's a little bit like when you go to school, you don't just get grades A, B, C, but you can get either a straight B, it might be a B minus, B plus, A minus, straight A plus. And so if you're doing first jhana, if you do it really well, first jhana plus, you get the highest. If you just do a middle grade of first jhana, you get reborn in the middle layer. If it's a less satisfactory degree of development, we call it first jhana minus, then one gets the lower realm of rebirth. This is what they say. Okay, now the first jhana realm, or the lowest of these four bands or strata within the form realm, this is sometimes called the Brahma world, the Brahma loka. And the deities that live there are called Brahmas. The Brahmas are superior to the Devas. The Devas are the gods of the sense-sphere realm, the desire realm. But the Brahmas are superior to the Devas. Okay, now, as I said, in the first jhana realm, there are three divisions. And these three divisions are called, okay, the top layer is called the Mahabrahmas. The Mahabrahmas, these are like the kings or the superior beings in this particular Brahma world, the rulers. The second level is called the realm of Brahma's ministers. And the Pali word purohita, it's like the word used for the minister of or the chaplain of a king. These would be like the advisors, cabinet members. the attendants on Brahma who help him administer the Brahma world. And then the third level, the lowest level, this is called the level of Brahma's assembly. Those are the deities who just make up the assembly, the retinue or entourage of Brahma. And it seems, I get the impression that in the Brahma world, the three levels are not really separate realms of existence, but they are different statuses within one realm. Just as in our human world, we have, well, nowadays we don't have kings, but in ancient times there would be kings, then there would be the aristocracy, the ministers of the king. And then the king would have the regular, ordinary members of the court. And they're all living and interacting. And so it seems the same, the Brahma world is portrayed in the same way. Now it seems to me that Bhaka Brahma is one of the Mahabrahmas. That is, he is the ruler of a particular Brahma world, or a particular part of the Brahma world. Now, according to the Buddha's teaching, existence in all of these realms is impermanent. Beings come in, they're reborn into these realms as a result of their merits, their past karmic deeds. In the case of the Brahma world and the higher realms, as a result of their meditative attainments, their attainment of samadhi. But the karmic power of the merits, even the karmic power of the meditative attainments, is finite. Eventually it is exhausted. And so after the beings exist within these realms for some time, they pass away. But there is a particular problem which arises in these realms, and that is the lifespan there is said to be extremely long. And because the lifespan in these realms is very long, lasting, we would say, millions of years, even billions of years, the beings who are living there forget that they have arisen there, that they were reborn there. And they're not aware of the impermanence of life in those realms. And so they give rise, or they're disposed to give rise to the delusion that this realm is permanent and eternal. And so this is, we might call this the theme of this particular sutta, is to expose the insufficiency, the inadequacy of existence in the Brahma world because of the impermanence of life within that world, that realm of existence. I would suppose that this sutta was devised the way it is particularly for propagation amongst the Brahmins and those influenced by Brahmanism. According to the Brahmins, the supreme ideal or supreme object of aspiration in the Buddha's time was to be reborn in the Brahma world, to be reborn in the company of Brahma. And so the Brahmins imagined Brahma to be a permanent, eternal deity, the creator and sustainer of the whole universe. And their ideal, through the performance of the rituals of the Vedas, the practice of asceticism, the practice of samadhi meditation, their ideal was to be reborn in the company of Brahma. And they imagine that when they're reborn in the Brahma world, then they will be able to live there forever, either in union with Brahma or in the company of Brahma. And so we have to remember that the Brahmins were very influential as teachers in India in the time of the Buddha. And so it seems to me that this sutta was devised the way it's come down to us for the purpose of, you could say, this exposing, revealing the inadequacy of the Brahma world as an ultimate goal. The Buddha himself claimed that he could teach the way to the Brahma world, but the Buddha didn't emphasize the practice of the asceticism or ritualism as the way to the Brahma world, but instead he taught the four Brahmaviharas, the divine meditations of boundless loving-kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. But the Buddha didn't retain the Brahma world as the ultimate goal of his teaching, but he pointed beyond the Brahma world to the state of ultimate liberation, which is Nibbana. Okay, so now we come to the beginning of the sutta, and here the Buddha is relating, he's living in Savatthi, and he's relating to the monks something that had happened on an earlier occasion when he says he was living at a place called Ukkata. Okay, now on this occasion, what's called a pernicious view or a bad speculative view had arisen in the mind of Bhaka the Brahma thus. And what is this view? This is permanent. This is everlasting. This is eternal. This is, the text uses a word kevala, which means the translation total. Maybe the ultimate would be a better rendering. This is the ultimate. This is not subject to pass away, for this is where one is neither born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears, nor takes rebirth. And beyond this, there is no other escape, or maybe you could say no other state of liberation beyond this. Okay, and so now this deity, Bhaka the Brahma, is imagining that his realm is a realm that's permanent, eternal, everlasting. Okay, and so now the Buddha, while he's sitting, meditating at this foot of the tree, he's able to read the mind of Bhaka the Brahma, and he thinks that he has to dissuade him from that view. And so then he vanishes from his place in the human world and then reappears. He uses his psychic power to travel to the Brahma world. Okay, when he appears there, Bhaka the Brahma welcomes him and then loses no time to proclaim the superiority of his own realm. Again, he just repeats the same line. This is permanent, everlasting, eternal. Okay, now the Buddha tries to correct him. So the Buddha says that the worthy Bhaka the Brahma has fallen into ignorance. Avijagato. He's gone to ignorance, lapsed into ignorance, because he says, now the Buddha is sort of giving it to him straight, without taking any kind of roundabout route, but the Buddha just lays it down straight, that you are speaking of what is impermanent, saying it's permanent. You're speaking of what is transient, saying that it's everlasting, and so on. You're speaking of what's non-eternal, saying it's eternal. You're speaking of what's not ultimate, saying it's the ultimate. And then this, which is subject to pass away, you say it's not subject to pass away, and so on and so on. Okay, and so the Buddha is just completely contradicting Bhaka the Brahma. And when we come to that sentence at the end where he says there is no other escape beyond this, all of this one finds exactly the same in the short sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. But at this point, the sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya goes off in a different direction. But here, something very interesting takes place at this point in this sutta. At this point, Mara, who is called the evil one, takes possession of a member of Brahma's assembly. Okay, now who is Mara? Sometimes Mara is interpreted symbolically as a symbol for the defilements, a symbol for birth and death. But also, in the Buddhist text, Mara is regarded as, we could call him, an evil-minded deity who tries to prevent beings from gaining enlightenment and liberation. Mara is not like the devil in Christianity in that he has no connection with hell. Mara has no interest in persuading people to do really bad deeds that will bring them to a rebirth in hell. Mara, from the Buddhist standpoint, well, let's say from a mundane standpoint, we could say Mara is not really an evil one, but a good guy. He wants people to enjoy themselves, to have fun, to have a good time, to enjoy sense pleasures. But his one task is to prevent them from gaining release from samsara. And so the way Mara has to do this is by persuading beings to give up their efforts, to give up their striving, and to enjoy the world. And so here we have, I call this a situation which maybe from the standpoint of Christianity would be unthinkable, that Mara is going to join forces with Brahma. You could say that Brahma represents the god of theism, and Mara is like the devil. But here, Mara becomes the ally of God, trying to persuade the Buddha to worship God and become a devotee of God. So Mara says to the Buddha, he calls him somewhat disparagingly, he calls him Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu. He doesn't call him master or blessed one, but he just calls him monk, O monk. Do not disparage him. Do not disparage him. Now he's going to praise Bhaka the Brahma. For this Brahma is the great Brahma, Mahabrahma. He is the overlord, the untranscended, the one of infallible vision, the wielder of mastery, the Lord, maker and creator, most high providence, master and father of all those that are living now, and that ever can be. Okay, so in some suttas, we find Mahabrahma praises himself using exactly these same words. But here, Mara is taken over. He's taken possession of one of the members of Brahma's assembly, thinking that the Buddha, if Mara appears in his own form, he's afraid the Buddha will immediately recognize me and blow my game. And so Mara takes possession of this Brahma deity. And so it's this member of Brahma's assembly who appears to be speaking, but it's Mara who's speaking through him, praising Mahabrahma. Okay. Now Mara is going to use, or try to use, fear in order to get the Buddha to subordinate himself to Mahabrahma. He says, before your time, there were ascetics and Brahmins in the world who condemned earth and were disgusted with the earth. Who condemned water and were disgusted with water, who condemned fire and were disgusted with fire, and so on. He goes through this whole list of items. Who condemned air and were disgusted with air, who condemned beings and were disgusted with beings, who condemned the gods and were disgusted with the gods, who condemned Prajapati and were disgusted with Prajapati, who condemned Brahma and were disgusted with Brahma. Here Mara is using a kind of vocabulary, kind of terminology that was used. It's not typical Buddhist language, but it's a kind of terminology that would have been used by the ascetics in the Buddha's time. This Garahaka and Jeguchaka. It's this, I might call this ascetic evaluation of the world, condemning the things of the world and becoming disgusted with them. And so Mara is assuming that the Buddha also falls into that same category of this kind of world-denying, world-hating ascetics. And so then Mara goes on to say that these ascetics, on the dissolution of the body, when their life was cut off, they became established in an inferior body. This means that they were reborn in a lower world, a lower realm. Okay, so those who took, we call this the path of renunciation, of world rejection, which Mara sees the Buddha as following the same kind of path. So Mara says, they, when they died, they were reborn in a lower realm. So he's trying to intimidate, to frighten the Buddha into subjecting himself to Brahma and worshiping Brahma. And now Mara is trying to use now a positive approach. Now he's giving him not the whip, but the carrot, trying to induce him positively to worship Brahma. He says, before your time, there were ascetics and Brahmins who praised earth and delighted in earth. These words imply enjoyment and attachment. So they praised water, delighted in water. They praised fire, delighted in fire, and so on. And then on the dissolution of the body, when their life came to an end, they became established in a superior body. In other words, they had a superior rebirth. Okay, and so then Mara tells the Buddha, again, it's almost like a stern warning, be sure to do only what Brahma says. Never go against the word of Brahma. And then he tells him some of the negative consequences that will follow if he goes against the word of Brahma. Okay, when Mara finishes speaking, then the Buddha tells him, because the Buddha is able to know who it is that's speaking to him. So the Buddha says, I know you, evil one. Don't think that I don't know who you are. Then he calls his name. He says, you are Mara, the evil one. And then the Buddha makes now the most important point. He says, you are Mara, evil one, and this Brahma and Brahma's assembly and all of the members of Brahma's assembly, they have all fallen into your hands. They have all fallen into your power. And then Buddha says, you might think, I too have fallen into your hands. I too have fallen into your power. But I have not fallen into your hands. I have not fallen into your power. Okay, so this is an extremely important statement, and it shows we have here a triangle. It's not really simply a dialogue, but maybe you call this a trialogue? Is that a discussion between three people? So there's a three-point discussion, Brahma, Mara, and the Buddha. And in this discussion, it seems that Brahma is, on the worldly side, Brahma is the chief, and Mara seems to be the supporter of Brahma. But from the Buddha's perspective, their relationship is actually the reverse. It's actually Mara, who appears just to be very humble, devout, and even worshipful towards Brahma. But Mara is the one who, behind the scenes, is controlling the show. He's, you could say, the stage master, the puppet master. And Brahma, the supreme deity of Brahmanism, is just almost a puppet in the hands of Mara. And why is this the case? Why would this be the case? Why could we say that Brahma has fallen into the hands of Mara? Why is he under the control of Mara? Any ideas? Okay, this is one factor. So, Brahma is the victim of wrong view. Anything else? The expression was used at close to the beginning of the sutta that gives the hint. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. That he says, Brahma, you have fallen into ignorance. Well, Bhaka the Brahma has lapsed into ignorance. And so we say Brahma has fallen into ignorance. He's holding to a wrong view. And also, though not explicitly mentioned, one could say, or just one could see from Brahma's attitude that there's a kind of conceit at work here, thinking, I am... Well, actually, Brahma doesn't say this himself, but Mara says it on Brahma's behalf. I am... He is the overlord, the... one of infallible vision, the wielder of mastery, and so on. So there's a conceit. Okay, so we have... I don't know if I show the relationships well. And when I put Brahma on the top, I don't mean to put Brahma above the Buddha, but it just makes it easier to show the relationships that takes place in this dialogue. We say that the relationship of Mara and Brahma is one of their adversaries or opponents. And then in the dialogue, Brahma and the Buddha are opponents. That's an X between them, which means that they're at odds with one another. But I have the arrows between Mara and Brahma going towards the center, which means that they're joined in an alliance, that they're working together, both in opposition to the Buddha. Okay, so the Buddha declares that he is the one who's completely outside the control, the domination of Mara. Okay, so when this is said, Brahma again repeats his claim that his world is eternal. Again, he speaks about, he makes, you could say, claims of superiority. He threatens the Buddha. Okay, this is all in paragraph 7. And then I want to come in paragraph 8. We come to the key sentence. Or actually, even what comes earlier is important. In paragraph 8, the Buddha says, if I will hold to earth, that is, if I will cling to earth with craving, with enjoyment, and with the view of self, then I will come within your domain, and then you can work your will upon me and punish me. Again, if I hold to water, fire, air, and so on, I will come within your domain. In other words, if the Buddha clings to anything, affirms anything as being self, or holds to anything through craving, then he comes within, he falls within the realm of Mara, and then he falls within the control of Brahma. But now the Buddha says, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus. Bhaka the Brahma has this much power, this much might, this much influence. With this statement, the Buddha is indicating that he knows the limitations to Brahma's power. And so then Brahma asks him, how far do you understand my reach and my sway to extend? And then the Buddha responds in verse, and he says, as far as moon and sun revolve, shining and lighting up the quarters, over a thousandfold such world does your sovereignty extend. And there you know the high and low, those with lust and free from lust, the state that is thus and otherwise, the coming and going of beings. And then he says, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus, and you have so much power, so much might, this much influence. And so with this, the Buddha is saying that he knows that this Bhaka the Brahma is the ruler, the chief deity of what is called the thousandfold world system. This would be maybe something corresponding to the Milky Way. And so within this domain, say a thousand worlds or thousand solar systems, or even maybe a thousand galaxies, each with suns and moons, planets, and so on. Brahma, this Mahabrahma, is the chief ruler. But it's only that much that he rules over. Only that much that his power... It's only to that extent that his power extends. But now the Buddha says, there are three other realms which you do not know and do not see, and which I know and see. And now the Buddha is going to mention what these other realms are. These will be some of the higher realms, the realms of the other, these will be some of the other layers of existence within the form realm. So first the Buddha says there is the body, what we call this, the realm of the gods of streaming radiance. Okay, the gods of streaming radiance. These are the highest gods. This fourth one. Okay, the highest realm with, let's say, the highest layer within the realm corresponding to the second jhana, this is called the realm of streaming radiance. And the beings who live there, those are called the gods of streaming radiance. Now, according to the sutta, the Buddha says, there is the body called the gods of streaming radiance from which you passed away and reappeared here. This means that in his earlier existence, Bukka the Brahma was living in among the gods of streaming radiance. But then when his lifetime came to an end there, he passed away from that realm and he was reborn as a chief Brahma deity, a Mahabrahma within the Brahma world. But the Buddha says, because you have been dwelling here for such a long time, your memory has lapsed. You've forgotten this. And thus you do not know and see it. You don't know about even the existence of the Abhasara, of the gods of streaming radiance. But the Buddha says, I know it and I see it. And then the Buddha says, and this sounds it sounds a little boastful, but the Buddha says, in regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand even at the same level as you. How then could I know less? Rather, I know more than you. Then the Buddha says, there is the body or state of existence called the gods of refulgent glory. The gods of refulgent glory, that is the highest layer in the realm of existence corresponding to the third jhana. But the Buddha says, you do not know or see that, but I know and see it, and therefore my knowledge is superior to you. And then there are the gods called the gods of great fruit. That's a group of gods existing in the realm of the fourth jhana. And you don't know it and see it, but I know it and see it. Therefore, I know more than you. According to the commentary, and again, I have to say commentaries, I don't know where they get their information, whether it's completely trustworthy, but the commentary says that in an earlier life, Bukka the Brahma had been a human being, and as a human being, he had gone into the forest and lived as a yogi, and he had practiced the meditations. And through the practice of meditation, he had achieved and mastered the fourth jhana. By mastering the fourth jhana, he had taken rebirth amongst the gods of great fruit. He had lived there for a long, long time. When his lifespan came to an end in that realm, he passed away, and he took rebirth amongst the gods of refulgent glory. Then he spent a long time living amongst the gods of refulgent glory. When his lifetime came to an end there, he passed away, and he took rebirth amongst the gods of streaming radiance. And then when he passed away from that realm, he took rebirth as Bukka the Brahma, where he's living when the sutta takes place. And so all of this had taken place in the past, but Bukka the Brahma doesn't remember any of it. But the Buddha is able to know this through his superior knowledge. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions. Do you find this interesting or a little bit mythological? How about Marcy? Do you find this interesting or no? Okay, thank you for being candid.
I like the way they put the devil and God on the same team.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And the Buddha is just, we could say just a human being, but he's standing up to both this powerful team of...
Sort of turns like most of the world's beliefs on its end.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Current human beliefs.
Because usually we have the opposition as God and devil. Okay.
I wonder if you say it's the realm of form, this is the form realm.
Yeah.
And sense desires have no role.
Yeah, the sense desire is absent here.
So there's no craving?
There is a craving here, but it's not the sensual craving. What's present in this realm is still the craving bhava tanha, the craving for becoming. And there's also a craving based on conceit. Or we could say that the conceit is based on the craving. In order to be, to go on existing, one forms this conceit about being somebody important. Okay, maybe if there's no further questions, then maybe I'll try to go through and complete the sutta. Maybe we could strike up some interest. Okay, now the Buddha is going to go further and show where his knowledge is superior to that of Brahma. And again, I don't think the Buddha is boasting here, but the way I see I regard this sutta as something of a contrived sutta or a devised sutta prepared by the compilers of the canon in order to show the Buddha as having a teaching which is different from that of Brahmanism, opposed to Brahmanism and superior to Brahmanism. Okay, and so now the Buddha says, having directly known earth as earth, and then he uses a difficult expression, and directly known that which is not partaken of the earthness of earth. The Pali, it's very difficult. Patavin ko ahang brahme patavito abhinyaya. Okay, having directly known earth as earth, yavata patavya patavatena ananubhutang. Yeah, the key expression here is ananubhutang. The word means an is negation. It negates. Anu has a sense of along with. And bhutang means existent, existing. So the Buddha says that he is known that which does not exist along with the earth quality of the earth. And according to the commentary, what this is referring to is Nibbana. Nibbana is that which is beyond everything conditioned. And so it's not existing along with all of these conditioned phenomena that are going to be mentioned. So since the Buddha has directly known earth as earth, and he's known that which lies beyond the earth. He did not claim to be earth. He did not claim to be in earth. He did not claim to be apart from earth. And he did not claim earth to be mine. Does this look familiar? Have we come across such expression before? Anybody recognize this? Exactly. It's the same pattern that we find in the first sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. And so the Buddha, when he says that he's directly known earth as earth, well, this has very wide implications, but we could say that he's known the earth to be impermanent, bound up with suffering, and not self. And so for this reason, he doesn't conceive himself to be earth. He doesn't take the earth to be myself. He doesn't claim to be existing in earth, to be existing as a self or a soul within the earth. He does not claim to be apart from earth, to have some I or self existing separate from the earth. And he does not take earth to be mine, to be the possession of a self. So we can say that these are all ways in which he's not affirming earth. And so because the Buddha knows that which is beyond the earth, in other words, Nibbana, and because he's free from all kinds of deluded notions with regard to the earth, he says, I do not stand merely at the same level as you. How then can I know less? I know more than you. Okay, then the same thing is repeated with each of the other items until we come to the most comprehensive formulation, which we also find in the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the first sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. Having directly known all as all, having known everything as it is, having directly known that which does not exist along with all conditioned phenomena. Having known Nibbana, I did not claim to be all. I did not claim to be in all. I did not claim to be apart from all. I did not claim all to be mine. In other words, the Buddha is saying that he's free from all conceptions, all ideas of self-identification, identifying himself as a self, a being, a soul, existing in relation to all phenomena. Okay, so in this way, he says, in regard to direct knowledge, I am superior to you. Okay, now Brahma is saying, Brahma says to him, if that is not partaken of by the allness of all, may it not turn out to be vacuous and empty. In other words, Brahma seems to think that if what you have known is not comprised amidst all conditioned phenomena, then it must be something which is empty, vacuous, non-existent. And then the Buddha makes a statement that I find somewhat difficult to understand. It's a little bit controversial statement. It's actually two lines of verse. Vijnanang anidasanang anantang sabato pabang, which means consciousness non-manifesting, boundless and luminous all around. Then he says, that is what is not partaken of by the earthness of earth, not partaken of by the water, waterness of water, and so on. That is not partaken of by the allness of all. So this gives rise to something of a controversy, because the Buddha is specifying this as consciousness, and the commentary says that what the Buddha has known is Nibbana. So this seems to be identifying Nibbana with a kind of vijnana, a kind of consciousness. And yet that goes against, say, mainstream Theravada doctrine. I don't know how to resolve this problem. I won't try to do it now. Okay, I'll try to finish going a little quickly through the sutta. Okay, now we come to what looks like a contest between Brahma and the Buddha. But this contest that takes place, on one level, it seems like they're just matching their supernormal powers against one another. But I would read a kind of symbolic significance into it. But first, let's see what takes place in the contest. Bhaka the Brahma says to the Buddha, I will vanish from you, I will disappear from you. Okay, so the Buddha says, if you can do so, try. And so Bhaka the Brahma tries to make himself invisible, to go beyond the sight of the Buddha. But no matter how hard he tries, he cannot vanish from the Buddha. Wherever he goes, whatever he does, the Buddha can still see him. Okay, so now the Buddha says to Bhaka the Brahma, I shall vanish from you. Okay, so Brahma says, go ahead, perform your feat. And then the Buddha performs such a feat of supernormal power that Brahma and his assembly and all the members of assembly could not see him. So the Buddha succeeds in vanishing from Brahma and the whole assembly of Brahma. So the way I see this or read this at the symbolic level, it means that even though Brahma has taken the superior rebirth so that he's ruling over the thousandfold world system as the chief deity with so many thousands of Brahma deities beneath him, but still he is within the domain of birth and death, still caught within samsara. But the Buddha can vanish from Brahma. Symbolically, the way I see it, this means that the Buddha has gone out from the conditioned to the unconditioned. He has attained Nibbana, even though still living as a human being. And because he's reached the unconditioned, then Brahma, whose mind is still blinkered by ignorance, cannot see him, cannot see, you could say, the unconditioned aspect of the Buddha's presence. But Brahma, in contrast, is fully within the realm of the conditioned. So no matter how much mystical power he uses, he can't vanish from the Buddha's sight. Okay, when the Buddha disappears, then to show that he's still around, he utters a verse. He says, having seen fear, or maybe better, the danger, having seen the danger in bhava, in existence, in becoming, in the round of rebirths, and having seen that every state of existence will cease to be, I did not welcome any state of existence, any kind of existence within the realm of birth and death, nor did I cling to delight, or nor did I cling through delight. In other words, this delight is the delight of craving. And so the Buddha has given up this craving and clinging and no longer holds or clings. Is somebody upstairs? Laosha? Laoshu, Laoshu, not Laosha. Significant that the sound comes at the time when the Buddha disappears. Okay, so when the Buddha utters this verse, then Brahma and all of the members of Brahma's assembly are all now, we could say that they're all won over by the Buddha. And then they praise the Buddha and they say it's wonderful, it's marvelous, especially that though living in a generation that delights in being, that delights in existence, becoming, that takes delight in existence, rejoices in existence, he has pulled out existence together with its root. The root is craving or delight. Okay, Mara is not yet given up. Again, Mara takes possession of a member of the assembly, and now all of them have now recognized the Buddha as the Buddha. They've all now expressed their appreciation to the Buddha. But Mara realizes that he's lost half the battle, since everybody is now expressing their admiration for the Buddha. So Mara wants to prevent the Buddha from teaching. He thinks you might be enlightened yourself, but don't try to teach others. And so Mara says, if that is what you know, if that is what you discovered, do not guide your disciples, whether they be lay disciples or those gone forth. Do not teach the Dhamma to others. And then Mara again tries to instill fear in the Buddha. He says that those who claim to be enlightened in the past and who taught others, they got reborn in the lower realm, whereas those who in the past claimed to be enlightened and didn't teach others, they got reborn in a superior realm. So then the Buddha says at the end of paragraph 29, he says, be sure to dwell inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. It is better not to speak the Dhamma. Do not teach, do not guide anyone else. It's interesting that after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he was still sitting on the bank of the river, Nairanjara River, reflecting whether he should teach or not, it was exactly that thought that comes to his mind. He thinks that this Dhamma is very difficult. If I were to try to teach others, nobody would understand it. Then he uses exactly the same expression. He thinks it's better for me to abide inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. But in that scenario, then it's another deity. This is Brahma Sahampati comes to the Buddha and then pleads with him, please go forth and teach the Dhamma. And then the Buddha agrees. But here, Mara is now trying to persuade the Buddha, don't go out and teach, just live quietly and peacefully. Again, the Buddha calls his number and says, do not think I don't know you. I know you are Mara, the evil one, and you're not speaking out of compassion for the welfare of others. It is without compassion that you speak thus. And the reason why you are thinking thus is because you are afraid that if I teach the Dhamma to others, they will escape from your grip. Okay, and so then the Buddha just ends by saying, whether the Tathagata, if he does not teach the Dhamma to disciples, he remains such the enlightened one. If he teaches the Dhamma to others, he remains such the enlightened one. And then he says, why is that? Because the Tathagata has abandoned all the defilements and so on and so on. Just as a palm tree whose crown is cut off is incapable of further growth, so the Tathagata has abandoned the defilements, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so they are no longer subject to future arising. And at that point, then Mara is unable to reply anymore. Okay, and that brings the sutta to an end. Okay, if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yeah, Pat.
Is Baka's next rebirth going to be as a human?
I don't know. I don't know anything said in the text about his next rebirth. Yeah, Tom. Yeah. I have to say it's not a model of perfect lucidity, the verse. These are actually two lines it seems that they're taken from another sutta which occurs in the Digha Nikaya. This is sutta number 11, the Kevatta Sutta. In that sutta, there's a monk who has been reflecting, and the question comes to him, where do the four great elements cease without remainder? And then that monk goes to the different classes of gods asking that question. That monk apparently had spiritual powers, and so he goes to the gods in the different heavenly realms, and each class of gods directs him to go up to the next higher realm till he comes to the Brahma world. And then the followers of Brahma tell him, you should go to Mahabrahma and ask him that question. If anybody knows, he will know, since he's omniscient. And so the monk goes to Brahma and asks him, where do the four elements come to an end without remainder? And then Brahma says, he uses exactly the words of this sutta, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the overlord, the untranscended, the father and master of all who are and will come to be. But the monk says, I didn't ask you about your titles. I'm asking you, where do the four elements come to an end without remainder? And I think three times Brahma makes that claim, and three times the monk insists on his questions. Then in the sutta, Brahma takes the monk by the arm and leads him away from all of the other deities into a little secluded corner and says, I have to tell you the truth. I don't know the answer to your question. Don't tell any of the others, but I don't know myself. But you've done a foolish thing. Your own teacher is the Buddha. If anyone can answer that question, it's the Buddha. So why do you come to see me? You should go back to Earth and go to the Buddha and ask him that question. So then the monk goes back down to the human realm, comes to the Buddha, and asks the Buddha, where do the four elements cease without remainder? Then the Buddha says, your question has been wrongly expressed. What you should ask is, where do the four elements get no foothold? Where do they get no grip, nothing to rest upon? So then the monk asks the Buddha that question, where do the four elements get no foothold? Then the Buddha answers with the four-line stanza, of which these are the first two lines, vijnanang anidasa, consciousness non-manifesting, boundless, luminous all around. Here is where the four great elements get no footing. Here it is where name and form, long and short, beautiful and ugly, cease without remainder. Then with the cessation of consciousness, all this ceases, something like that. The commentary identifies that consciousness with Nibbana, but then it explains the word vijnana in a way that I find not so acceptable. It says this is called consciousness in the sense that it can be cognized, can be known. But usually consciousness is that which knows, not that which is known. So this is my supposition, that what is referred to by consciousness here is a kind of consciousness. It's not Nibbana, but it is the consciousness that knows Nibbana. And this is the special consciousness that is achieved, the way I understand it, by the Arahant in a special samadhi, a special kind of meditation in which he has the direct experience of Nibbana. And that consciousness is called non-manifesting in the sense that it doesn't manifest any of the phenomena of the world. So we could say within this consciousness, there's no earth, water, fire, air, no beings, no gods, no Pajapati, and so on. None of this appears within this consciousness. But the only object of this consciousness, if you could call it an object, is Nibbana. And this consciousness is something which is boundless because it has no boundaries, no limits, and it's an extremely luminous state of consciousness. That's the way I would understand it. But again, it's just my theory. And other people have different explanations. Okay, any additional questions? Okay, if no questions, then we'll stop for the evening. And next time I'll come February 10th and probably the 17th. Should we try sutta number 50? Again, it's another sutta which is a little bit strange, off the beaten track. Let me ask by a show of hands. Don't be afraid to say so. Did you find the sutta interesting? All those who found the sutta interesting with the explanation, raise your hands. Okay. So then we'll do number 50 next time. Okay. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, asking them to rejoice in these merits and protect the true Dhamma, protect the world, protect ourselves and others. Akasata jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantung Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantung Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampad sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya etava tacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.